On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
But I do want to get to my first guest this morning, Professor Philip Nolan, who is the chair of the mathematical modelling team at NEFET and also the president of Maynooth University. Good morning, Philip.
Morning, Gavin.
There will be a lot of people who will want me to address the zero COVID issues with you, and I will get to that in a few minutes because we could fill the whole slot talking about that and nothing else. So there's a few other issues that I do want to address first, if we can. Firstly, we now have what you might call the full return to testing. Now people, all close contacts being tested irrespective of symptoms or not. What impact do you project that will have on the case numbers and indeed on the R number?
Yeah, well, I mean, to start with the good news that we're now at around 1,300 cases per day, down from 6,800 cases per day, and we have a 14-day incidence of 537, down from 1,500. So the public have done an extraordinary job to bring those numbers down and to have a reproduction number in the region of 0.4 to 0.7. But you're right, there will have been a small number of cases that we've missed because the asymptomatic contacts, close contacts of cases, are not being tested. That might inflate those numbers by as much as 10%. So it is entirely possible that over the coming week, we'll see a bump in the figures as we detect those people now that the testing of close contacts has been relaunched. And I just say to people, don't be disappointed, don't be put off if we get stuck at around 1,300, 1,400 cases a day for a period of time. See it for what it is, detecting cases that we would have been missing for the last 3 or 4 weeks. They would have been perfectly safe because they would have been advised to stay home, but we simply wouldn't have tested them. And then we would expect to see the numbers. The most remarkable thing, I think, about the last couple of weeks is, despite this being the third wave, the fourth experience of public health restrictions for people in Kildare, Leash and Offaly, we really have stuck with it. We've seen the danger of allowing this virus to spread. We've stayed home. And unfortunately, even though we've got the good news of where the numbers are, we're still only at the level we were at the peak in October. So if you think about where we were coming in December, 250 cases a day, 14-day cumulative incidence of 80. If you think where we were in July, 20 cases a day, and a 14-day cumulative incidence of 3. We have a considerable way to go. We have weeks to go before we get case numbers down to a level where we have strategic options to open up our priorities.
And I suppose that it is an important point to make, again, just to recap what you said at the start, that even though numbers might otherwise be falling, the fact that we're now testing asymptomatic people means the numbers will inevitably maybe surge a small amount or plateau, but it's not something to be worried about. It's just the results of testing everyone. Okay. The projections on terms of hospital numbers do seem somewhat volatile as well. I don't know if you were in attendance at that cabinet subcommittee meeting on Monday night, but certainly the Taoiseach said that the briefing he was given on that night was that best case scenario at the end of February, there could be between 800 and 1300 people still in hospital suffering from COVID-19. Then on Thursday evening at the latest NEFET press conference, you were there, you presented your models, and you said that already the best case scenario was 600 to 700. It's a fairly dramatic change in the course of a week. How do they change so quickly?
Yeah, and so I was, and the numbers that the Taoiseach gave were the numbers we gave him. Numbers in hospital are very hard to predict. And also, we were only really 2 weeks into the restrictions at that point. So it wasn't clear to us how quickly case numbers were coming down. So the numbers presented to Cabinet on Monday were numbers from model runs the preceding Wednesday. And the numbers that were presented at the NEFET press conference on Thursday evening were numbers from a model run done a week later,
which is fair enough, because obviously as things change, you're running a new model, you're reaching new projection.
Exactly.
But it still does seem to be relatively volatile that you could be projecting 1,300 in hospitals in one model and then a week later it's coming down to 700.
Yeah, but not quite, because if we pull back, the preceding week's estimate of reproduction number was in the region of 0.5 to 0.8. Last week's estimate of reproduction number was 0.4 to 0.7. And that makes a huge difference. And I would have said on several occasions, each Thursday really, that the case numbers were as good or better than some of our more optimistic projections. So in feeding back to the public that, if I could be blunt about it, we had done a better job than I expected in bringing case numbers down, that feeds on into hospitalizations. But I think the bottom line here is, it, you know, 1,000 people in hospital, 800 people in hospital, 700 people in hospital, they're all too high. They're all higher than the peak that we had in April. So the government, there's no concern that the government was making decisions on the basis of flawed information. They were making decisions on the basis of projections telling them that even by the end of February, case numbers in hospital would be of that order of magnitude, and sufficiently high that they really needed to take the actions that they've taken over the last weeks.
Yeah, and I suppose that does raise the question again as to what you do on March 5th if you are in a position to relax some of the restrictions. And that, I think, ties into some of the zero COVID arguments, which we'll come back to then in a couple of minutes. One other point, though, before we get to that, you did also observe on Thursday night that the infection rates, and even if you discount nursing homes or other facilities like that, infection rates for the older age cohorts are still stubbornly high. Is there any explanation or any theory as to why they're not coming down at the same rate as they are for other age cohorts?
Yes. One of the things about social mixing, which leads to viral infection, is that we tend to mix within our own age groups. And the over 65s in our community are highly interconnected. They mix amongst themselves, and then they have common people they mix with. It might be their younger family members, it might be people who are coming to care for them. So unfortunately, when the disease gets into that cohort of people, it tends to spread within that cohort of people. And it's also difficult to drive it out of that cohort of people because they have these inevitably tight connections amongst themselves, where either older people caring for each other or younger people caring for older people.
So, without trying to boil it down too much, that effectively, even though we're all in lockdown, the fact that older people still need a certain amount of outreach or a certain amount of social care means they're slightly more interconnected than the rest of us are.
Absolutely, and it's also in strict numeric terms, and I don't want to kind of reduce people to numbers, but in strict numeric terms, it's also a small segment of our population. So the total population size is small. So as I say, even modest numbers of cases within that population give you a very high incidence, and it's very difficult to drive it out.
Okay, which is a fair point, actually, that they're kind of skewed percentage-wise at that level. Is there a practical floor, then, with that in mind, through which case numbers probably can't fall, especially given that the new variant is here?
No, it is theoretically possible to drive case numbers down to practically zero. In any cohort, it's simply a question of time. So, for instance, the case numbers in those age 75 and older and 85 and older are falling. They're just falling from a high level, and they're falling somewhat more slowly than the rest of the population. So there isn't really a level below which we can't go. It's much more a question of for how long can we maintain this level of social distance, because it's not easy not to see people for weeks on end. How long can we keep that up, and to what extent can we keep that up? And that's what drives the level of infection.
Okay.
But if we stay apart, then the level of infection inevitably falls towards zero.
Okay. This brings us on then to the zero COVID issue, which was put to you at the press conference. And a lot of people will probably have heard the response that you gave there. For people who didn't, you argued that, you know, we have to accept that in the circumstances of this country, no such system, and such system being zero COVID, would be perfect and guarantee complete exclusion of any new disease or any new variant. And I'll get on to the rest of what you said in a minute, but just first of all, the circumstances of this country, do you basically mean a country that shares a land border with another jurisdiction, or do you mean something else?
No, it's much more complex than that. And I think it's important to start with the commonalities here, that there's a shared objective here to bring case numbers to a very low level, as close as practicable to zero. That's the only way that we can start to safely reopen our priorities. There's also a shared objective, and you alluded to it in the headlines there, to absolutely minimize the risk of importation of new cases or new variants into the country. There's a shared concern to empower and resource our regional public health departments so they can track down new cases, and there's a shared ambition for timely and widespread vaccination. Where I differ is that some of the advocates, and I have profound respect for public health colleagues who are advocating for zero COVID, so-called. But where I differ is the advocates who say, when that is done, we can go to level one or level zero. The kind of sunlit up plans of a zero COVID approach. And my concern is I simply don't think that that is a realistic proposition. And I think it's of concern to say that kind of thing to the public, because the reality is we're going to be living with social distancing, masks, very limited social gatherings, no non-essential travel for some considerable time. And I think there's an obligation on those of us who are advising government to be straight about that.
Okay, I think where they would disagree, and I have to sort of somewhat play devil's advocate here because we don't have a representative of that cohort to talk back to you, but they would say that they're not promising that sort of short-term turnaround. They're not saying that everything can be completely normal by Easter or very shortly afterwards. I suppose the argument is that they've seen what the government has done previously, where cases have gotten down to a relatively low level, and then we've taken the foot off the gas and we've allowed it to come back again. And effectively what they want is for there to be one big bang so that you do get community transmission down to virtually nothing, and that then you have very aggressive controls on both incoming international travel and very aggressive domestic contact tracing, so that there's not necessarily zero COVID, but zero tolerance of COVID, which is not what we've seen up till now.
But I think if you go back through the public statements, you'll find many circumstances under which after St. Patrick's Day or after Easter, our lives will return to normal. And my concern is that given the circumstances of this country, given our public health infrastructure and given the nature of our border, I simply don't think we can be as effective. We can't be absolutely effective in terms of preventing importation. We can't be absolutely effective in terms of interrupting every chain of transmission through public health interventions, even though all of those things are important to strengthen and important to resource. And there have been statements that say at that point, you know, we can fill Croke Park full of people and watch a match. That's not going to happen, in my view. And that's the false promise piece. And my concern is that talking about border control and talking about aggressive find, test, trace, isolate and support, both of which are really important, they distract us from the fact that for months to come, the first line of defence against this virus is going to be our own behaviours. So I want that piece taken out of the narrative that our lives can return to normal. And what needs to be inserted is our lives can return to a cautious form of living where we maintain social distance and hygiene practices, and we only open up those things that are real priorities. Education, the ability to visit each other's houses a little bit more, non-COVID healthcare. We need to think about what's important to us in the months between April and September.
Well, let me put it to you maybe in a slightly different way. And let's assume that the border, we know that the border is an issue and that you can't really mount a border blockade. So you can't necessarily inhibit all travel coming from one jurisdiction into the other. And that's, I think everyone accepts that if we're in a different world where that could be coordinated, then it's a different story. But if the Republic were hypothetically an island and you had community transmission down to virtually nothing, and you did have aggressive community testing and tracing so that whenever there was even a spark of COVID that you could trample down on it very quickly, why in that circumstance where there was effectively no community transmission would you still need to observe social distancing and not have mass gatherings, not have people in Croke Park or the Aviva or Thomond Park or wherever else?
Well, absolutely. Like in a theoretical position where you have reduced the prevalence of the virus to such a low level that the risk of a social gathering is minimal. In other words, that the risk of in any group of, for sake of argument, 10 or 15 people, it's highly unlikely that there's somebody there who's asymptomatically carrying the disease, then that restriction would be unnecessary. But I think we have to face a reality that we are less self-sufficient as a country than countries that have achieved zero COVID. We are more connected. And there has been huge investment in particularly test and trace infrastructure to prevent spread of the disease. There's the need for ongoing investment in the much more specialist and sophisticated regional public health departments that intervene in the management of more complex outbreaks. And I think, as I say, we have to be honest and realistic with people. There's an awful lot that we can do to reopen our priorities, to reopen our schools, to reopen sectors of our economy that are safer,
so then
to mix a little bit more socially.
So then when might we be in a world where it would be considered safe or appropriate to go back and having people in, you know, a concert hall or in a sports stadium?
That kind of thing. I do honestly think we're waiting until the point where vaccination has brought us close to or at herd immunity. And there'll be many other things that we'd be able to do before that.
No, sure. I know that they're the extreme examples. That's where you're putting tens of thousands of people into one area.
I mean, frankly, before we're all packed indoors in an intense social setting, or there are very large mass gatherings, we are going to have over 70% of the population immune. And probably higher because of the new variants. But until we're approaching that herd immunity threshold, those kinds of large or very crowded indoor social gatherings are not going to be safe.
Then just on a related note then, and one other thing I wanted to talk to you about was some Norwegian studies which suggest that transmission between children and from children to adults is relatively low. They would be the one, that cohort would be the one gaping hole if we're depending on herd immunity, because there is no vaccine that's been trialled and which is sanctioned for use under 18s yet.
Yeah.
So does that mean then that you wouldn't necessarily have to worry about vaccinating children if peer-to-peer transmission is quite low there, that you could vaccinate all adults, achieve herd immunity that way, and then once that is done, ideally by September based on current timetables, that's when you can consider normality again?
Well, that's something we're going to have to watch very closely. I mean, first of all, that study's very good news. It's confirmation that, I think there's an important caveat in that, it's in a circumstance where we have low to medium community transmission. So NEFID's position has been that in circumstances where we've low community transmission, schools appear to be safe environments where there's minimal chance of transmission. And this study confirms it, that in primary schools with low to medium community transmission, there's almost no evidence of transmission from children to children or children to adults. So that's very important support when it comes in over the coming weeks to beginning to reopening,
Does a study like this accelerate NEFID's view about the possible reopening of schools, or whether it will be advisable to do that?
I think it supports the established position. There's evidence from our own country, and there has been evidence from abroad about the very low probability of transmission within schools, and this study reinforces it. In terms of vaccination, we've a way to go yet in terms of assuring ourselves that vaccination also interrupts transmission.
We don't know that for sure.
Probable
yet.
That it will, but as you know, we don't know yet. Mm. And in the context, as we do vaccinate more and more populations worldwide and see the impact of that, we'll understand much more tightly whether vaccinating or not vaccinating children represents a risk in herd immunity terms.
Very finally, and I'm reluctant to end on what might be a downer, but I don't know how you're going to answer this question, but you also said on Thursday night when you gave those new projections that still by best case scenario you could have 200 to 400 cases a day by the end of February, towards the first week of March, which is when lockdown would aspirationally be ending. That is, as everyone will remember, the similar case numbers that we had at the start of December, and then look where we ended up afterwards. To your mind, do we need to extend restrictions beyond March the 5th, or is it realistic to expect any kind of relaxation at that point?
I think from the earlier part of your conversation, you appreciate that my position is we'll be living with some level of restriction, whether it's level 3 or level 2, for quite some months to come. So I think if we're at 200 to 400 cases by the end of February, it does give government options. If we look back on December, that you might reflect that there's some things that we perhaps could have done and other things we shouldn't have done. Mm. And I think government and ourselves will both be looking back on the lessons learned right through the pandemic. Looking then at the level of infection and community transmission that we face towards the end of February, and we can then form advice about what do we think is safe to open at that point and what should remain closed, and government will make a decision.
But without prejudging all of that, obviously it would be a fairly modest relaxation if we're still back at the same scenario we were at the start of December.
Yeah, I shouldn't prejudge it, but I mean, anybody can see if we go back over the previous waves that the approach that we took in the summer, for instance, if we go back and look at the summer, there were times at which we opened up certain aspects of society, but case numbers continued to fall because we weren't opening up those settings in which there was a high risk of transmission. So I think the important thing to do here is go right back. Look at the lessons that we learned in May, June, July 2020 and apply those lessons to March, April, May 2021.
Okay, we will leave it there. Professor Philip Nolan, Chair of the Mathematical Team at NPHET and the President of Maynooth University, thank you very much for giving us so much of your time this Sunday morning.